First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to present these results. And I would also like to acknowledge that I did not work this out all by myself, but in collaboration with my supervisor, Professor Schlickeiser, and also Professor Peter Yoon from the University of Maryland. And the topic I'm going to cover is the generation of magnetic fields, and in particular the magnetic Sears fields, which are required for this, and the role played by the spontaneously emitted fleet fluctuations in the intergalactic plasma. And just some introductory remarks about the generation of cosmological magnetic fields. It seems to be a general consensus that the observed field strengths can be explained by not too many mechanisms. Most prominent is it some kind of dynamo action, be it large scale or small scale. There are others as well, like flux conserving compression or plasma instabilities, first and foremost the Weibull instability. However, all of those mechanisms cannot create magnetic fields out of nothing. They are only means of amplification, and therefore they require the existence of small but still existing seed fields. And it has been shown that orders of magnitude about 10 to the minus 20 Gauss are sufficient. And a very common mechanism is the Biermann battery, where basically the different masses between electrons and protons give rise to small currents, which in turn induce some tiny seed fields. There are other mechanisms discussed as well, seed fields generated during inflation or during cosmological phase transitions. And there is one other aspect, which is a purely plasma theoretical effect. And these are the spontaneous field fluctuations in the intergalactic medium. And when I'm talking about fluctuations, it's more in the sense of electric and magnetic fields rather than some quantum effects. We are just talking about classical plasmas here. The intergalactic medium is of particular interest because it might still contain the seed fields in their unperturbed initial state. However, the difficulty with all of this is that there are almost no conclusive observational data available as yet. And in order to gain some progress, we already heard that Neronov and Wolf tried to derive some lower limits on the field strengths. However, we also heard in the first talk this morning that these are not entirely compelling because the non-observation by Fermi can be explained by other plasma effects as well. And therefore, we have to start our calculations from scratch again and just theoretically calculate what the magnetic field intensities from such fluctuations are. But first of all, let me explain to you what I mean by spontaneously emitted field fluctuations. And if you consider the phase space density in six-dimensional phase space, what does it look like? On a macroscopic scale, where you consider really independent, discrete particles, of course, each of those particles will give rise to such a delta peak, because every electron, for example, has a distinct position in space, and it has a distinct velocity or momentum value. And therefore, in phase space, every single particle is such a delta peak. However, usually we do not describe a plasma with such delta peaks, but we rather take the ensemble average. And this averaging is also mathematically speaking, is also smoothing, because if you think, for example, of the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution function, you can see this is a smooth Gaussian function, and this is the ensemble average. Therefore, by definition, you have a fluctuation in the statistical sense, because you have a deviation between the microscopically correct value of the phase space density and the ensemble average. And this is just due to the particle discreteness of the plasma, and therefore it is independent of the field fluctuations because it's just due to the particle discreteness. However, there are also, also at the same time induced particle fluctuations because the, every particle has a charge, and therefore it induces in the electromagnetic medium of the plasma will induce some fluctuations. And just to give you an idea how this comes about, we have already seen the linearized Vlasov equation. However, this assumes basically a smooth plasma of smooth of no discrete structure of the particles. And if you want to take this into account, you have to start your calculations from the Klimontovich equation. And if you linearize this, then you get this term here, which accounts for the spontaneous fluctuations due to the particle discreteness up here. And basically, this is the linearized Klimontovich equation. If you perform a Fourier Laplace transform, then you end up with such an equation because this operator basically becomes an algebraic expression absorbed here. And since the current density is basically the charge density times the velocity right here, this is the kinetic version of this, you end up with spontaneous current densities as well. And as you know, every current is the source of fluctuations or of waves. You can easily calculate how large these spontaneously emitted field fluctuations are. And if you do this, you have to plug this spontaneous current into the wave equation. And in the case of a plasma, this is a form of the wave equation. On the left-hand side, you have the Maxwell tensor, which is up to an additional constant, basically the dielectric tensor. So it describes the electromagnetic properties of the plasma. And this, in this general form, this is holds for arbitrary distributions, be it thermal or otherwise. On the right-hand side, you have the source term, which describes the current generating the waves. And of course, in the equation, you also have the waves generated because they are connected to the others. Now, in particular, you are interested in the dominating mode of the plasma, as we heard in the previous talk. And if you want to calculate the emission into the transverse mode, since we are interested in magnetic fields, cannot calculate electrostatic modes because they are longitudinal and therefore are not connected with magnetic fluctuations. Therefore, we have to calculate transverse modes. And if you want to know the emission into the transverse mode, you basically just assume the density with this mode given by a particular dispersion relation omega into this mode. And then you, if you sum this up, you have this intensity in the mode here. And if you solve the wave equation, you end up with a generalized radiation law that accounts for the competing effects of spontaneous and induced emission and absorption into this mode. And basically, if you ignore this part here, this is exactly what we have seen in the last talk in quasi-linear theory, because there you have the twice the gamma factor. This is basically related to the energy density. However, now since we are interested in the spontaneous effects, we also have to take this factor into account, which basically relates the spontaneous. Other way. We have seen this in the previous talk. This comes about due to the spontaneous emission. I'm sorry. And now for long-term evolution, you see that this. If you solve this equation for constant coefficients, then you see that this this evolves towards an equilibrium, which is basically just given by the ratio of the two parameters, and this allows you to calculate the fluctuating spontaneous magnetic fields. However, this result is still very general in that it is independent or it's valid for any arbitrary distribution function and the mode governing this distribution. Now we have to specialize this for the intergalactic medium. And in order to model the IGM as it is today, we assume a thermal distribution function with a temperature of 10^4 Kelvin and a density of 10^-7 particles per cubic centimeter. And now the interesting part is that a few years back, there has been a new mode discovered dominating this thermal IgM. And the basic idea when it was discovered was to perform an analytical continuation of the fluctuating fields. And you can clearly see that over the growth rate gamma and the wave vector spectrum, that here for negative values of gamma, that you have a dominating mode, which is by several orders of magnitude larger than the non-collective modes apart. And if you calculate the fluctuations, then you end up with a spectrum like this. This solid line here is for the magnetic field fluctuations, and this dashed line here is for the electric field fluctuations. And you can clearly see that this is a non-Kolmogorov type of spectrum that we found here. Now, integrating over all the entire wave vector spectrum gives you a value of 6×10^-18 Gauss, and therefore this is even larger than the famous Biermann battery, and therefore the spontaneously emitted field fluctuations really are a great candidate for magnetic seed fields. And they have due to the omnipresence of the intergalactic plasma, they have a much higher volume filling factor than, say, the Biermann battery. Now, the idea that we had is that you might have even significantly stronger field fluctuations if you take the effects of the beam into account. And the physical picture, we have seen this today already, is that you have an AGN that is sufficiently far away from us. And it emits TeV gamma rays, which interact with the soft photons of the extragalactic background light. And when they do so, they create electron-positron pairs that penetrate the intergalactic medium. And due to the overall charge neutrality of the pairs, no return currents are induced. And we can take this effect separately into account. Now, it has been shown before by Schlicker et al. In 2012 what the pair production spectrum looks like. And you can see clearly that it is very sharply peaked around this value. And therefore, we can assume, at least to a first approximation, that the beam is monochromatic, meaning it has a sharp energy, as modeled here with this delta function. Moreover, the angle has been calculated between the initial TeV gamma rays and the direction of the created pairs. And this mu here is the cosine of the angle. So 1 minus mu is the deviation from the forward direction. And you can see that depending of the collision angle here, which is parameterized here, you see that it's at the order of 10^-14 maximum. So these beams are highly collimated in the forward direction of the high energy gamma rays, as you would intuitively expect as well. So therefore, it is it's a very good approximation to assume that the beam is such a delta function. And now you can redo the calculations I've shown you before. And what's the basic physical effect that it will have? Well, first of all, the Maxwell tensor entering the wave equation is altered. You have this part describing the thermal background, and also you have a part describing the beam. And very naturally, such a factor epsilon describing the density ratio between beam and background plasma occurs. And this is an ideal basis for perturbation theoretical treatment that we applied here. And since the beam gives you a preferred direction as opposed to the wave vectors, which might be in any direction, and opposed to the isotropic thermal distribution, therefore this tensor is no longer diagonal, and the resulting Kirchhoff radiation law becomes a tensor equation in this case. However, it can be shown that the dispersion relation, which is given by the determinant of the Maxwell tensor, still remains the same, at least to first order in this perturbation theory. And what you can see is that basically the effect is that you get an effective growth rate now, which is the growth rate of the unperturbed background plasma, plus an extra term due to the beam. And now the interesting effect is that you can have the formerly damped mode, which describes absorption, can now become unstable, at least in some wave number regions. And this means negative absorption, hence amplification of the field fluctuations. And the question now is, under what conditions does this occur? Because it depends not only on the wave number range, but also on the parameter values. And we looked into this and found that it depends very much on the orientation of beam and wave vector. And with beta, I denoted the dimensionless relativistic velocity of the pair beam. And it depends, the condition for amplification strongly depends on the orientation of this velocity with respect to the wave vector. As you can see here, you have field fluctuations emitted in arbitrary directions, meaning for arbitrary wave vectors. However, in all the other directions, not non-perpendicular to the beam, there's absorption, as was the case without the beam influence. However, in the direction perpendicular to the beam, amplification of the fluctuations does occur. And this for exact perpendicular propagation, this always occurs. Otherwise, it also depends on the density ratio of beam and background plasma, and also on the gamma factor of the beam. And I will show you the growth rates right now, which really prove that these calculations are correct. First, the case where you have an exactly perpendicular orientation. And in this case, you can see that the effective growth rate really does become positive in this case. You can see this line here describes the unperturbed growth rate. And due to the presence of the beam, you can see here that it becomes positive, depending on the value of beam and background plasma shown here. Of course, it can never become infinitely large, as shown here, but this is where we leave the linear regime assumed in our calculations. Now, the interesting question is, what happens if the beam and the wave vector are not exactly perpendicular to each other, as we assumed here? So what we now do is we take a very small vector of beta parallel, but not exactly zero. And in this case, the change a bit. As you can see here, this is still the unperturbed growth rate. And now it does not become infinitely large, but only a small bump. But still, the important point here is that you get positive growth rates, and therefore amplification in this wave number range here. And we also looked at the dependency of the parameters. In the top row, the opening angle between beam and wave vector remains the same, and what we changed is the density ratio between beam and background plasma. For example, you can think of moving closer to the source or closer to the AGN or going further away. And in this case, here's epsilon is equals 10 to the minus 15, 10 to the minus 20, and 10 to the minus 21. And what you can see here is that the maximum moves further to the right until it at least is too small so that there are no regions of amplification left anymore. And the same or similar effect occurs down here, where the beam and background ratio remains unchanged, but the opening angle will become changed. Beta parallel 10 to the minus 11, 10 to the minus 9, 10 to the minus 8. And you can see here also that the region of amplification moves further to the right. So what the takeaway message at this point is that the spontaneously generated field fluctuations in the AGM really can serve as magnetic seed fields, because they are, even in the unperturbed case, of the order of 6 times 10 to the minus 18 Gauss. However, if you consider the pair beam created due to some distant AGN, then you end up with regions of amplification of these modes. And we hope that once we perform the calculations, collecting the contributions from all wave numbers and performing the integration, that the fluctuation level will be somewhat larger even than in the unperturbed case. Thank you.
Much questions. So I was wondering why the magnetic field fluctuations were so coherent. You had this key to zero in the thermal case.
They are not coherent. They have a coherence scale of the order of 10 to the minus 4 parsec, so 10 to the minus 10 megaparsec. So these are really small-scale turbulent fields.
Okay, so but when you showed the power spectrum, it looked like at low wave number, the power spectrum was flat. Yeah, that flat.
Yeah,
yep.
A 10 to the parsec, right? So what cuts it up, or why? What happens here? I mean, in principle, there's nothing that the steady-state solution doesn't hold at low K.
Okay,
so I see.
You see this. It was
actually increases as k cubed at low k. You see that solution not there.
Yeah.
That assumes that t times mu k is greater than unity, and mu k is k dependent, k to the minus 3. So if you go to a small k, you can't make it. But if there's some break k, whereas you take the opposite of it, the limit that mu times t is small, and then it's just alpha times t, and it increases as k cubed.
Not scale,
I see. But small.
So does that then mean that these fluctuations do not solve the Hare-Halo deflections because they're not over long enough length scales?
Well, they can, because this is an aperiodic mode. So this the resonance of the particle is not with a delta function. It's non-resonant diffusion. So it can also scatter the particle. Although it has to be determined how strongly.
Mm-hmm. Just because you're going through a lot of these, so your particle diffuses, is that?
No, the problem is these are fluctuations where the real part is zero. You only have an imaginary part, so you cannot use the standard diffusion coefficient, which are taken for you. Mm. But sorry.
No.
That answers my question. Thanks.
Yeah.
I guess I have another question.
Yeah, sure.
So I guess another thing that I could think of happening in the IGN is you just have cosmic rays streaming through normal cosmic rays. Does that, it's not as anisotropic as these pair beams, but would that have an effect?
If you consider hadrons instead, or what was the question?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, but in this case, I guess you have to take account of the return current. And so I haven't done this yet. I'm not sure how this is done.
Well, like for the current, they're even more powerful, if I remember correctly, right?
This is an MHD calculation, so I don't trust this belt. If he would show me a kinetic
But I think this has been done. This has been done. There was a kinetic treatment of the bubble order.
Numerically.
But there's also the other instability, the streaming instability, which again requires a. But of course, it's an electromagnetic one, the electromagnetic field.
It damps the one way and it amplifies the other. Yes. So you have to be really careful. Damps the forward one and amplifies the backward one. They never tell you whether they are talking about a forward moving or a backward moving in this way. So, I mean, I might be wrong.
Yes. This is a rather general question, so apologies for asking you, and in fact, I think Christoph answered it about 4 years ago, but I can't remember the answers from last week. Which is, in a typical place, intergalactic medium, you don't have a beam. You have 100 beams all pointing in different directions. Mm. So this must change the picture a bit, right? And nobody's really talked about beam opening angles, how critical they are to this picture. And presumably, at some point, if the beams are too wide or I have too many sources, I have isotropy, and then this doesn't help. Yeah. So what's the sort of critical conditions for this to work at all?
We looked into this, and our conclusion was the beam is very narrow, and I think Randall agrees. I mean, 10 to the minus 14 sort of is a sort of deviation. That means
10 to the minus, actually, 1 minus mu is theta squared.
Okay,
so 10 to the minus 7 radians.
This is of
an
electron.
Deviation from the direction of the gamma ray, where you could get a little spread of particles in the perpendicular direction.
Yeah.
But the spread is very small. It's more than 10 to the minus 7 radians.
Right, but the gamma ray.
One beam. But you are now saying there's another beam coming from another place.
Yeah. There are 100 beams, but nevertheless, they're still locally in an anisotropic situation, right? Because then there are 100 beams, each of which are very narrow, and all your modes care is a local anisotropy, which is still given. You're not fully isotropized, which would be the limit at which would basically kill the free energy.
Right, but I'm just curious, I mean, from a sort of plasma physics perspective, how different is the situation of 100 beams?
So,
you call it the test setting to show it for n equal 1?
No, no, I mean,
you complete an action or something.
It just seems, you know, we started this, you know, this morning thinking about...
Come back in 5 years.
I mean, it must depend on how many blazers you have and how many beams.
We
only see a certain fraction. We only see those that are being to us. So there are many that are being in another direction.
But like right now, we know already of 40, 50. That
right, if
our spots.
I assume that we're not in a special place.
So, and then typically this is down by a number of 5 if you get Fermi map. So at least there are 200, 300 hitting us.
Yeah.
If we are not special in the universe, every spot should be hit today. I mean, around redshift shield. Now, if you're of course not holding the evolution, then the number goes down. But most of those places are very weak. Only a few actually can drive instabilities like this.
I think you can have to be careful. Yeah. What matters is the Biot-Rolle factor of the jet that tells you about how many blazars there are. They don't all have 10 to the 6. This is just what you produce by this pair production.
Right, but I mean, I see TV emission from 60 objects or whatever, right?
Yes.
Here.
In reality, there are 10,000.
So with different angles. Yeah.
So another way of understanding it is that, like, so when you do the calculation of plasma physics, right, what happens with that problem? You need to count the waves that are resonant with a particular beam, right? So if there are 100 beams, right, you will have a lot more waves, but not every wave will be resonant with more than one beam. That every wave will be more or less resonant with just one. So you're basically reducing that per wave basis to just one beam.
Okay.
Now the upshot is that basically there could be crosstalk between the different waves.
Mm-hmm.
But then you talk about basically wave coupling, and that's a whole other can of worms.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this is the question: is the picture of sort of superposition of all these things in a nice linear way,
right,
or not?
Yeah. So at least in the plasma side, you can break them up because things that like the only things that matter for the instability on a per wave basis is that for this wave, is it resonant with some thing, with some B, right? And it's only really resonant with one B, right? But then when you start talking about the other situation, then it gets a little more complex.
I mean, Antoine showed this paper by Watson this morning, right?
Yeah.
So, and they looked at the number of beams. This question has been discussed in the past couple of years, whether how many beams do we need to mimic an almost isotropic situation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are you guys saying though that like if these instabilities go nonlinear, that like you would think everything would couple though, right? Or you think it's you could still.
The question is this way: how are they going nonlinear?
Okay.
So I mean, like in principle, you can have crosstalk between different waves.
Yeah.
But the condition is pretty severe because you have to have the wave vectors, some of the wave vectors for you is zero, and then some of the modes plus and minus, or the omega all is zero as well.
There's lots of the timing. I mean, we only see the beam when the laser is flaring. If the flare is over, the gamma ray intensity goes down. I think it's very unlikely that two blazars in this universe flare at the same time and then meet the beams with each other. So it's also something you have to take into account. So this will not happen all the time if there is a strong living flare. Otherwise, these growth rates will become much smaller.
So principle's coffee now schedule. So I would suggest to actually keep those questions and